headphones if you were. I'm Faith Middleton, and this show is about the richness of life. We're going to talk about how you should be treated as a hospital patient. Thanks for listening in Connecticut, Rhode Island, Massachusetts, and New York, including the East End of Long Island. Yesterday, I went for my annual mammogram at Yale, and the images were remarkably clear because of Yale's advanced 3D mammography machines. Luckily, good report for me. Excuse me. But as medical diagnostic technology advances and awes us, it could be argued that something else is in danger of disappearing among medical professionals: the ability to make judgments that recognize the humanity in every patient and in the relationships among doctors and patients. Machines can and will give us all pieces of information practitioners need, but machines cannot sit back and judge things like this: that it might not be appropriate or humane to scope a dying man with severe prostate cancer in service to cure at all costs. Diagnostic machines, no matter how smart, cannot know how to tell a patient that lethal and advanced cancer is present, or recognize that your spouse's actions are making you sick. It's not that medical personnel, especially younger ones, care less these days. It's that medical schools, hospitals, group practices are being called upon to be more personal, humane, philosophical, and ethical as technology makes things more impersonal. This is why I'm keenly interested in the work of Dr. Michael Benick. An experiment he conducted at Yale New Haven Hospital recently made front page news in the New York Times. He wanted patients in one hospital unit to sleep, to rest. And anyone who's been admitted knows that, and this is wildly counterintuitive, hospitals aren't places for patients to get enough sleep. Why? Is it always necessary to wake up patients throughout the night for diagnostic tests? We're about to tell you what happened when Dr. Benick tried something new. In addition to having a private practice in gastroenterology and teaching at Yale Medical School, Dr. Benick is in charge of something at Yale New Haven Hospital that's new. And he's called medical director of the patient experience. And so he looks at patient-centered philosophy of care. What would that look like if you had to be hospitalized? And how would it affect the kinds of conversations you and your medical advisors have during office visits? Will medical staff be motivated to buy in to what Dr. Benick and a whole team of people are proposing now that docs are under siege from insurance company regulations and systems that steal their time and test the reasons why they chose medicine in the first place? Dr. Michael Benick, what a treat it is for me to have you here. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Faith. I'm really glad to be here.
Always so great when I'm with you. So you just did grand rounds at Yale, and you mentioned a quote about the ideal in patient experience.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned that, because I think that these issues facing physicians and caregivers and the way in which they are able to effectively reach their patients and families, there's been problems in that world, in that sacred space, for a long time. And it's not just the technology that stands in the way. It's very interesting. The quote you refer to was a quote given by a very famous doctor, actually at Harvard, not at Yale, a gentleman by the name of Dr. Peabody. And he talked about how the treatment of a disease always has to be impersonal, but the way in which we care for patients has to be completely personal. And it's the significance of that relationship between the physician and the patient that can never be too strongly emphasized. And he argued in 1926 that in an extraordinarily large number of cases, both the diagnosis and the treatment of patients and their families are dependent on that understanding, and it's the young physician's inability to recognize that and to establish the relationship that creates the ineffectiveness in the care of patients. And in the quote that I used in my grand rounds, And if there was nothing else that you and your listeners would remember, he ended it with, "For the secret of the care of the patient is in caring for the patient." And I think that is the greatest challenge for all of us as we try to provide care for our patients.
Are you talking about doctors, nurses, medical staff having empathy?
I think it's about empathy and showing that we care, and it's about being able to really be present and see things from the perspective that our patients and their families are experiencing. And that's the challenge, and that's where I think the entire focus of hospitals in America have been shifting.
I went back in preparing for this show and looked at a couple of journal articles, and I thought, what's going to happen if I type in this phrase, patient-centered care? And I see that this actually goes back quite a ways, and yet the definition of it has been evolving. It went from patient-centered care to something called relationship-centered care, and we can get into that later, but... One of the things that somebody said, because there was a lot of talk about empathy, compassion, feeling for another person, that doctors were afraid that they would feel like phonies or were perceived as phonies because they want some professional distance there. And patients said the same thing, that they didn't want somebody to just talk the talk. They wanted somebody to feel it, to really act as if they cared.
Well, I think that that is an incredibly important observation. I think that the reality is that our patients have very straightforward and important goals for all caregivers to be reminded of. They want to be valued. They want to be listened to. They want it to be cared for and about. And they want to be treated as an individual. And the extent to which we as healthcare providers only rely on scripted language to help create that relationship will always result in us falling short of having accomplished our goal of really being present in the life of our patient.
How do you tell the young medical student then to be sincere, to be authentic in this, in a relationship with a new patient? What does that sound like?
Well, it's funny. It's one of my favorite new words is the word exidentesiast. I had never heard of it before and recently came across it. It means one who hides their true feelings behind a smile. And in many ways, one of the approaches that the service industry has is, you know, standing behind your desk, smiling and not really being present. Although I think those things are incredibly important, you have to remember that this is not the service industry of hospitality. This is about patients who are in crisis and in need and who really do need to be cared for and about. And I think that one of the ways we can accomplish that is by helping students and trainees to understand the importance of how they communicate and create a common agenda with their patients when they meet them. It's much easier said than it is done.
It is. I can't imagine how hard it is for I think this about people calling into the show sometimes. I think, you know, they don't know where they're calling. They hear of various of us on the air, but when the number's given, they can't possibly know what's on the other side of that dial, and yet people are courageous enough and generous enough to do it. The same would be true in the hospital setting, of course. You know, probably those nurses and docs have had a stay in the hospital, and that must be very enlightening.
Well, I think that whenever a hospital employee or a physician or nurse has had an experience for themselves or with their families, it enriches their ability to understand the needs of patients. But if you go back to even how you opened the interview, talking about trying to create an environment for our patients at Yale New Haven Hospital where we let them sleep, there are always remarkable challenges that you don't even anticipate.
So let's get to sleep.
Okay.
Because this was pretty fascinating. Front page of the Times. What did you decide to do with regard to sleep?
So I'm going to step back for a minute and share with you some of the current issues facing hospitals, promising to return to this question about sleep. Every hospital in America is measured on how patients experience their health care. It's a survey sent to everybody, and there are 27 questions that every patient who's discharged from Yale New Haven Hospital will receive within days of their discharge. One of those questions that they're asked was, how quiet was it around your bed at night? Therein lied my first recognition. What's true for those of us asking questions and what's true for those of us answering those questions may be different. And I said, maybe what that question is asking of our patients is, how well did we let them sleep? And I thought long and hard about what it was that we did as caregivers in pursuit of providing them, our patients, with better care that would interrupt sleep. And there were three things that quickly came to mind. The first was obtaining vital signs, taking blood pressures and pulses and checking temperatures. The second was giving people medications. You know, the old joke of waking the patient up at 2 o'clock to give them their sleeping pill. Mm-hmm. And the third was obtaining blood tests from our patients so that the doctors and other caregivers would have the results earlier in the morning. And I recognized that we did those things because it fit our need to get information, but it didn't necessarily respond to the many needs that our patients have when they're in the hospital.
I'm going to hold you off right there. We're going to take a break, and on the other side of this short break, I want to hear what happened when you conducted this experiment. What happened with those patients? Stay with us. We'll be right back. I'm Faith Middleton. Thank you so much for joining us. I am with Dr. Michael Benick, who's a gastroenterologist and is medical director of the patient experience. This is a new position for Yale New Haven Hospital. He's also associate chief of the Department of Medicine at Yale. And we're talking about patient-centered care is another way of putting this, or relationship-centered care. So, Dr. Benick, you start to look at this idea of people needing sleep in the hospital, and that the rules have been arranged, and in some part, understandably, for the sake of the physicians who are coming in early to do rounds so that they can see their patients during the day. Okay. So what do you decide to do?
So when we started this experiment, it was during a month when I was the attending on the teaching service at the hospital, and I said to my team, let's sit around and figure out what it is we can do differently. And the first thing that we did was we took a look at how the order got put into the computer as to when the vital signs were being taken. And it turned out that for most of our patients, the default was to be every 4 hours. So not every patient really required an every 4 hour blood pressure, pulse, and temperature. Having recognized that, we worked very hard to change that to every 8 hours, or what we would call every shift. That opened up a possibility of doing things in a different way, not that fit our needs, but rather that was really responding to what the patient's needs were. And so we decided to have our caregivers on the floor take the vital signs every 8 hours when it was clinically appropriate, and we came across several problems. Our caregivers had a work life where they would come on at 11 o'clock. They would take on their new list of patients. And by the time they were getting to do these vital signs, it could be 12 or 1 o'clock in the morning. Clearly, we had to shift our thinking. And so rather than doing it at the beginning of a shift, we did it at the end of a shift. And that allowed us to make the 10 o'clock hour the hour for obtaining our vital signs, and then 8 hours later at 6 a.m. and 8 hours again at 2 in the afternoon. That provided a real opportunity to change our workflow. And we decided we were going to then bundle care. So if there was an opportunity to give a medicine 3 times a day, we would also give the medications at that same time of day. The hardest one to work on was having the doctors get comfortable with not having their labs at the crack of dawn ready. And that we still work on. But we're even beginning to address that with greater efficacy. But returning to the experiment, what I did with my team was I said, if you need to get labs that urgently, then it's a clinical requirement that you let me know. And I asked them to call me and wake me up before they woke the patient. Creating that personal awareness allowed them to shift their focus and orientation, and there were no phone calls. That it allowed them to anticipate what they needed, so they got their labs either first thing in the morning or later on at night.
So what was the outcome of this? I mean, those lucky patients got to sleep, which is a rare thing in the hospital, ironically. First of all, is there any truth to rest and healing? Is there a real link there?
So we could take an entire day to discuss the benefits of sleep and the problems with the lack of sleep. In this particular case, let us suffice it to say that sleep provides the immune system with the opportunity to be better armed in fighting off illness. And the lack of sleep interferes with that immune system in every way imaginable, making it less resilient and less potent in its defense. And so what we did, returning to the actual measurement, was we had not been very successful on the floor where we worked. The month before I came on service, patients said only 16% of the time did they feel that it was always quiet around their room at night. But with making just these 3 simple interventions, and without doing anything to decrease the sound of alarms or talking in the hallways or noise from roommates, patients said almost 46% of the time it was quiet always. And I really do think it was a direct result of sleeping.
And there were no medical issues.
So there were I never have a problem in responding medically. On 2 separate occasions that month, it was very important because of a patient's bleeding or a patient's having fainted that we did do vital signs, did draw blood tests, did give medications, but it was clinically required. It was required by their medical illness, not required because it made our work life easier. And that's the fundamental shift in the type of patient-centered care I think we're trying to foster everywhere at Yale New Haven.
So I have to ask this way. How do you get buy-in for something like this? We see the friends we know in medicine, the people who are our clinicians in medicine, everybody connected with that field is complaining right now because of more regulations and complicated systems and the lowering of fees to the point where now some procedures, doctors are now losing money, not just staying even, but losing money on. How do you get people to buy in to make their lives more difficult than they are right now? These medical people are burning out, as you know. There are threats of lawsuits right and left. How does that happen?
So I think that's a very important and very difficult question. And I'm not sure that I'm going to adequately answer it. But what I do know, having been in the field for 30 years and interviewing medical students who want to become residents and residents who want to become fellows and meeting all of the new young attendings that come on staff at Yale New Haven Hospital, they hunger to make a difference. And that when they hear the word value, I really don't think that they're reaching for their wallets and their pocketbook. They're reaching for how they can do their jobs better. And although there is a tension, because there's an expectation that we have to do things in a more patient-centered way, and sometimes that does take time, and those competing demands of work and life and work and money are always there, I think medicine is a very different profession than most. And those of us in it want to keep it that way. There's a poet who lives in Connecticut, Courtney Davis. She's a nurse practitioner. And she said something that rings so true to me. She said, "Medicine is a transcendent profession where the realities of the body are the surest pathways to the mysteries of the soul." And I really think that for many caregivers, even if they might not put it in that language, they recognize the importance and meaning of the work that they do as they seek to cure where possible and care always as they do their work. But I don't want to minimize the difficulty of the tension between trying to meet multiple competing issues.
Dr. Benick, I was looking at this Journal of Internal Medicine, and they were doing the Fetzer Institute and the Pew Trust got together and looking at this sort of relationship or patient-centered care. And they said, let's do a little history. Back in 1969, somebody at the forefront of this movement said, quote, "Each patient has to be understood as a unique human being." Would you describe it that way? When you're talking to new docs coming to practice or ones that have practiced a long time and, you know, want to stay in touch, is that how you would put it?
Yes, I would. Yeah, and it's funny how the thoughts that were going through my mind as you were introducing this hour and you were talking about your mammogram and the incredible wonders that are available to modern medicine that we have at Yale New Haven, to be able to really visualize things. And I think that the eye provides us with the ability to have accuracy, but it's the ear that gives us the ability to hear truth. And there's something in patients' stories and with their unfolding of the emotional and social context which their complaints and their illnesses reside that allow the caring physician of today to better respond. And that's more than what can come from just looking at a great mammogram or a new technological advance. It really requires a different set of skills that have to equally be honed through teaching and practice and feedback.
You're talking about listening.
Yes.
And I wonder, just as we are all seeming to understand that empathy, compassion can be taught, it's a muscle that can be built with practice, can listening be taught? We all know from experience that some people are better at this than others. Is that just the difference in wiring, or like empathy, can that be taught to listen very hard?
So there are always going to be individuals who do one thing better than another, and that's just natural. But to feel that it's not possible to get better at any set of skills seems to be a false premise. At Yale New Haven Hospital and at the Yale School of Medicine, we are firmly committed to the fact that skills can be taught, can be enhanced, And we work very hard with our trainees to try to provide them with an opportunity through the use of role plays and simulation and other techniques that allow people to improve their communication skill sets, to gain entry early on within the first minutes of an interview so that patients can actually feel that they are being heard.
And what are you saying about how that should go in those first few minutes? Because you talked about this at Grand Rounds, I think.
Well, first to recognize that patients don't necessarily want us to fix everything, but they definitely want those that are caring for them to show that they care. Secondly, to recognize that the symptoms often have a personal and emotional context, so that what they're complaining of, but why they're choosing to present it now, usually has a clue to better understanding their illness. And that by doing things in an open-ended way, meaning not asking yes-no questions, but giving patients an opportunity to describe what it is that they're feeling, often is much faster and much more effective in getting their story out.
There is a talk about a teacher at one of the esteemed retreat centers, I think in Barre, Massachusetts, the Insight Meditation Center, this monk who came, and when he was lecturing, he put his hand on his heart, he pointed to his heart, and he said, "In my mind," as if his mind were located in his heart. And I was hearing the story, and the person said to me, because that is, if you go back to the time of the Buddha, that was how it was seen, that there was a marriage of the mind and the heart. And in true mindfulness practice, you wouldn't separate those two things. Is that what you're getting at?
So the answer to that simply is yes. In fact, that type of active listening, truly being present, is critical. And it's not just enough to understand the patient's situation and perspective and feeling. The really good caregiver has to then be able to communicate that understanding back to the patient and their family.
So let me tell you a story of this. I found this in, we had a mutual friend, you and I, Dr. Sherwin Newland, Shep Newland, and who has is no longer with us. And he tells a story about meeting a man who's a Holocaust survivor, and a young resident went to the man at his bedside in the hospital, and the man, and he said to him, "Oh, I see it says somewhere that you were hurt, you were in the war, were you in the Holocaust?" "Yes, I was." And he said, "Tell me about what your experience was there. What was that like for you?" And this man began to tell, and after a time, he was in that place. And he started crying and was kind of thrashing about. And this young resident held his hands. And the next thing he knew, the resident had wrapped his arms around this Holocaust survivor, and he wept and wept. And then he said to the young resident, said to the patient, "You are not there, Mr. Schimmel. You are here with us right now, and no one will get you there anymore. You are here with us." And very slowly, he began to calm down, and suddenly he pulled away from this young doctor and stared at him and understood. "Oh, I am here. I get this." It's very clear he felt heard in a way, and Dr. Newland was saying he would just never forget it.
Well, I think that's really one of the magic moments of being in a position where, by virtue of your training and the needs of patients and at these critical junctions, that they allow you access to this incredible vulnerability. And the degree to which you don't shrink from that, but rather allow yourself to be fully present, allows both the patient and the caregiver to leave that encounter being richer for the experience.
This is Dr. Michael Benick, who is a gastroenterologist, but also medical director of the patient experience. This is new, a position at Yale New Haven Hospital. He's also associate chief of the Department of Medicine there. So there is a concern, I guess, that doctors have had about vulnerability and too much identification with a patient. I get that. Because you think I'll burn out. I'm really taking the stress on your behalf. There's only so much of this I can take. I'm seeing so many people. You know how that goes. So doctors called this detached concern.
Mm-hmm.
I want to indicate to you that I'm concerned about you. I care about you. But I'm protecting myself. And so I have a bit of detachment here. The problem is that patients can feel it. What do we do right there? I'd love to hear your answer on the other side of this break. Detached concern. Is there a place for that, or should we get rid of that and go with full vulnerability? We'll be right back. Faith Middleton, thank you so much for joining us on the show with Dr. Michael Benick of Yale. He is in charge. He's director of the patient experience, a new position at Yale New Haven Hospital. He's been a gastroenterologist and teacher at Yale for a long time. And I would say this is an important moment for Yale in terms of this direction, and a very powerful one. This is all a discussion about moving toward more patient-centered care, looking at things from the perspective of the patient as often as is humanly possible. So, Dr. Benick, what about this detached concern? Is it healthy, actually? Or do we want to go for full-blown vulnerability from our medical people?
Well, I think that full-blown vulnerability would be hard to manage, because the fact is that the issues raised as we struggle to respond to disease that can be cured and to diseases that can't are profoundly moving. And the ability to maintain wisdom in how we respond to the needs of our patients clearly requires a certain degree of protection. But I don't think it needs that detached concern that allows for a wall to exist between patients and their caregivers. There's a difference between being empathic and understanding what someone's going through, and then being so sympathetic that you're feeling it yourself so that it clouds your ability to be meaningfully directive and of help to your patients.
Is it a better way to say, I am side by side with you in this? Where we, in that image, there are two separate individuals. I'm not taking on your suffering entirely, but we are side by side going through it. Or is that also a false image? Because how do we know what grief is? How do we know what anything that powerful is?
So it's funny. The word patient comes from the Latin, I am suffering. And I think that is something that every caregiver needs to be reminded of, and that along with that suffering comes pain and fear, and there are certain things that we need to do to make sure of that as physicians we respond to trying to reduce that suffering. And suffering comes in lots of forms. It comes in the form of the disease. Sometimes it comes in the form of the treatment for the disease. But the things that we definitely can impact are the things that are associated with a dysfunctional system. Long waits, not being treated with courtesy and respect, not being included in the decisions that impact you. Those are the things that we can really be effective in reducing suffering and aren't relying upon that detached concern, but rather a shared decision-making process that allows physicians and patients to understand what's in their best interests.
How do doctors, though, with new insurance rules being what they are and visits being this long and bonuses for seeing more patients, you know, putting people through a mill, where do they get the time to have these kinds of relationships that you're describing? That's tough.
I think it's very tough. And I think that the pressures of making sure that you can provide patients with the care that they need and yet keep the system working requires a very delicate balance. And we need to really rethink how we optimize the health of our population. I think at Yale New Haven Hospital, we are very much dedicated to improving the quality of the care our patients experience. And I actually am worried about the proposed cuts that are being discussed at present in the state to finance hospitals.
You're talking about the governor's proposal to cut $300 million from hospitals in Connecticut. An entire one-third of that, $100 million, would come from Yale New Haven Hospital alone. Are you fearful that it would affect this particular program, or what in particular? What's your take on how that would hurt, considering that pain must be experienced everywhere in light of the budget problems?
So Yale New Haven Hospital is the state's largest safety net hospital, and I'm really proud of that fact. We care for everyone, independent of whether or not they have insurance or they don't, and whether or not what type of insurance. But 25% of our patients are funded through Medicaid and 35% by Medicare. That means 60% of our patients are coming through government pay. This reduction by a third will have dramatic and far-reaching impact on how we can continue to change the nature and how medicine is being lived in the lives of our patients and our communities. And I'm very concerned that efforts to try and teach caregivers to be more empathic, to take the time, to improve signage in the hospitals, to make things more accessible, efforts that we do on a daily basis that are often not even appreciated, like our discussion on how to let patients sleep or how to teach our trainees to be more empathic in their communication. But we have other commitments to the community that are also at the cutting edge of really responding to the health of our city and our state.
I hesitate to launch into how a government looks at this when there are, huge endowments that a university can call upon. I don't know what the governor's thinking is here, and we could talk for 2 hours about this. But I'm nervous about getting pulled off the track here, which is patient-centered care. So forgive me for leaving this for a second, or for the time being, I should say. So when a doctor comes into a room at the hospital, You have all established this new system of what happens from the moment the doctor comes in the room.
So ideally, what should happen is when the doctor should knock on the door. And that knock should be a request to enter and not the knocking of warning you that I'm about to come in. When the doctor comes in the room, they should introduce themselves, explain their role, ideally pull up a chair, and sit at a level with the patient and have the opportunity to really share in the process of informing and being informed by what's going on with the patient. We've added in every room in the hospital what we call whiteboards, which uses like an erasable ink pen to write down who the doctor is and their telephone number, who the nurse is and their telephone number, who's the patient care associate and their number, and what is the goal of the day from the patient's perspective, not from the caregiver's perspective, but it could be something as basic as to have less pain, to eat today, to go home. Those are very important things for all caregivers to be mindful of.
I want to thank our producers, Lori Mack and Jonathan McNichol, and our production assistant, Marion Roy, on today's show. So I am a lucky person. I have a brilliant and caring internist, Dr. Jill Banatosky, and she actually manages care. And the reason I'm saying this is that I hear from people so often that when they are thrown into the medical system with specialists because they have a specific problem that requires a specialist, there is this sense that there's a big gap and that no one, you know, who's managing everything? And suddenly the patient, him or herself, is faced with a variety of opinions and doesn't quite know what to do, and you're not necessarily going back to see this one until this. In the kind of work that you do now with this patient-centered care, do you eventually hope to get to something like that?
So I think that one of the dangers of medicine is the way in which it's fragmented. But I do think that technology can be as much of a boon as it is a hurdle. The ability to use telemedicine to communicate between patients and doctors, to have conferencing so that people can be on one page, the ability to provide information in a way that isn't dependent upon hearing it in that moment and then having those words fade into the background because our anxiety keeps us from truly hearing the fullness of what's being said. That is a real opportunity that we stand on the precipice of employing.
I'm trying to think, was it Howard Spiro who said, words matter. The words you choose as a clinician matter tremendously. What, to you, what did he mean by that?
Well, I'm going to paraphrase him because it's nice that we're beginning to wind down this interview with the same things that opened it up. You talked again about your mammogram in the beginning, and Howard taught me that medicine must exist in a world where patients are still persons, where the stories that they tell are as important as the abnormalities that we find on machines. Because it's in that world where love and hope and envy and fear are real, even though they may not be visible on our screens. And the ability to balance that cutting-edge high-tech with a direct and personable high-touch, that's the world where medicine serves its greatest promise.
What about the three questions that doctors and nurses and patients have that are the same? You did a survey, I think, and what were the three questions?
So this is actually a survey that's produced by the federal government. And the federal government, under the auspices of CMS, sends out a survey called HCAHPS, the Hospital Consumer Assessment of Healthcare Providers and Systems. And they ask 27 questions, but there are three questions that I think get at the core of what patients want from us as caregivers. And those three questions are the same for doctors as they are for nurses when it relates to communication. The first is, did we treat you with courtesy and respect? And the answer should be always. Anything less is inadequate. The second is, did we, as doctors and nurses, always listen to you? And again, the answer has to always be always. And finally, did we explain things in a way you can understand? Because if we haven't, then the opportunities for misunderstanding and not being aligned in a therapeutic project is at great risk. And that's one of the reasons I think we have high readmission rates at the hospital today.
Oh, yeah?
Mm-hmm.
Because
patients really didn't understand the importance of why it is we ordered this medicine versus that medicine. We didn't work together to find out that a patient was willing to not have surgery for this if they could have an intervention that allowed them to live with a condition in a different way. We need to be able to come to a shared decision and a shared model of making decisions that allow us to know what our patients want and for us as doctors to help guide them in fulfilling their needs.
I was looking at this Fetzer organization and the Pew Trust, Charitable Trust, who got together and began looking at what this has all evolved into now called relationship-centered care. And it came down to the caregiver and the patient being seen as in a friendship relationship. And they mean that in a slightly different way. But both in pursuit of the same goal, which is virtue. I was a little confused about that. I thought, what do they mean?
Well, I think it means that we need, as caregivers, we need to ask patients what's important to them. And that's going to vary by their time in life and where they are in their own journey. It's very funny. My father, who's 89 and has survived multiple surgeries, and I figure, you know, walks 4 miles a day, reads the New York Times every day cover to cover, would want everything done were he to get sick. And he was going off to Florida for this winter season, and my wife says, aren't you making an assumption? And I said, you know, you're right. She said, why don't you do what you've told all of your trainees to do and ask your father what's important? And so that's what I did. And before he left for Florida, I said, Dad, I assume that you want to have surgery. And he said, why are you making that assumption? And then he told me what he really wanted. He said, I'm so grateful for having made it this far. All I want to do is to make sure that I'm comfortable and that I'm surrounded by the people who love me. And I don't want to have surgeries, God forbid, that were to occur. And it was such a reminder to me on the importance of being open to hearing things from the perspective of those whom you're trusted to provide care and to care about. And my father, yet again, with the help of my wife, helped me realize just how important this is and how easy it is to lose sight of that goal.
Yeah. We're almost, we've got a couple of minutes here. So have you seen outcomes based on the changes you've made so far at Yale New Haven Hospital that are encouraging yet?
Yes. So a couple of years ago, if you measured how well we communicated as doctors and nurses, we would be in the 60th, 70th percentile. But today, in answer of the question, do we treat you with courtesy and respect, that component, we're in the 90th percentile. I think largely because we've trained people to knock on the doors, to write their names, to introduce themselves. But we still have work to do in making sure that patients understand things in a ways that they can understand, and that's a process that we're going to have to figure out how to intervene on successfully.
About language and time, it sounds like.
Right.
Thank you so much for being on the show, and we have a video of Dr. Benick talking about the meaning of suffering in a hospital setting, pain, insecurity in that setting, and it is quite powerful. Thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you, Faith.
Please be a guest anytime.
My pleasure.
Dr. Michael Benick is the director of the patient experience at Yale New Haven Hospital and associate chief of the Department of Medicine. As always, this show is about the richness of life, and you can find the books, people, videos, great recipes, value wines at the Faith Middleton Show at WNPR.org. In New Haven, I'm Faith Middleton.